So, Paul, do you? I wonder. We've already talked about this, where you're like, "Hey, look, I'm going to follow reason where it goes." Isn't like the Catholic teaching that like Thomas was right and you should be like a hylomorphist? What do you think about that? Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase. And this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is another special episode. I have with me Dr. Paul Herrick, and we're going to be talking about his book, Philosophy, Reason, Belief, and Faith, which is, equal parts a intro to philosophy book as well as a philosophy of religion book and like a cumulative case argument for God. It's really cool. I'll let him describe it a little bit more for you here. Before we do that, though, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen. Everyone who's supporting it over on Patreon, you guys are awesome. Seriously appreciate you guys. If you have benefited from this podcast, if it's your top five favorite, top 10 favorite, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. I'd love to do this full time. I'd love to dedicate all my time to giving you guys awesome episodes in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. Another way you can support the podcast is right over here. There's a super thanks button, and you can click that and give a one-time gift if you like this episode or other episodes. Please do that, and that would also be another huge support for me. We have some new stuff going on. We have the Parker Pensies Pont Sears Facebook group where we're having conversations over there, but we also just added a Discord server. So there's the Parker Pensies Discord server. I think you can probably find that link in the description. I'll drop that. And you can come talk with us. We're having some fun conversations over there. Lots of good memes, all sorts of good stuff. So those are some ways you can support. If you're listening on Spotify, now that they have ways for you to rank the show too, please leave me a 5-star on Spotify. If you're listening to Apple Podcasts, you guys forgot about the comments and stuff. I need those. Please give me a 5-star rating and a comment. It helps the algorithm think this is a good show. All right. Well, without further ado, let's bring in Paul Herrick. And again, the book is Philosophy, Reason, Belief, and Faith, an Introduction. And that's Notre Dame Press. So, Paul, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
Thank you for having me, Parker.
Yeah, so we got in touch through a mutual acquaintance and mutual friend, Jim Slagle. And for those listening, Slagle is awesome. He's the epistemological skyhook guy, the evolutionary argument against naturalism guy. Go check out the previous episodes with him there. So I'm really glad, Paul. Thanks for sending me this book. How about a little bit about you? Where'd you do your PhD and what was that on?
I did my graduate work at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I did my dissertation under Bob Coburn. And my dissertation was on John Rawls's theory of justice.
Mm, awesome. Why'd you pick that? Why did that interest you, I guess?
Well, Coburn was this marvelous, wonderful human being and a mentor to me and also a theistic philosopher of the apophatic kind.
Okay.
And I just admired him so much. And Rawls was one of his central influences. And I was fascinated with political theory. And I think through Coburn, I got turned on to Rawls's political philosophy and Nozick's competing philosophy, and focused on political theory in my dissertation. But at the same time, I was wrapped up in a lot of analytic philosophy of religion as well. And Coburn was friends with Plantinga, and I got to meet Plantinga through Coburn.
Nice.
I really admired Plantinga, and his work was hugely influential, as was Richard Swinburne's when I was a grad student.
Awesome. Between the two, I guess, this is a tough question, but would you think you would side more with Plantinga than with Swinburne?
Well, I side with Plantinga on the ontological argument. I've defended it many times, but I'm more with Swinburne on building a cumulative case for theism. based on multiple arguments woven together like the strands of a rope.
Yeah.
For theism, I think a rational case can be made for belief in God, the soul, free will, and objective morality rooted in God's eternal nature.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I can see how the two go together, especially given like Plantinga's modal ontological argument, you need to establish that possibly God exists. And then once you get there, then the whole argument goes. So maybe you can use a cumulative case like a Swinburne type in order to show that first premise of the modal argument.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, you could. So I'm not a reformed epistemologist. I'm more of a classical foundationalist.
Cool. Nice. Well, so Paul, you got this book here, Philosophy, Reason, Belief, and Faith. And the way I'm seeing it, you know, I read a review of it too, that you sent over. It looks like an intro to philosophy book, which is pitched from a theistic perspective that also functions as a cumulative case for theism. Does that sound right?
Yes. That's very perceptive. It's also a Socratic introduction to philosophy, because throughout the book, I raise Socratic questions and let students answer them on their own.
Okay.
But yes, it's a theistic leaning textbook, but it's also traditional, because I point out in the introduction to the instructor that theism has, belief in God has been the mainstream in philosophy since the very beginning. Thales was a theist. The next two philosophers were theists. Most of the ancient Greek philosophers were theists. The atomists were an exception. But theism has been the mainstream. Even Hume was a theist, if you read his dialogues to the end. It's been mainstream since Thales in the 6th century BC. And I'm not going to apologize or express regrets for having a theistic leaning book. It's in line with Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and so on down the line.
Well, and I like that too, because I study philosophy of religion, and sometimes I've been kind of bashful about that, but the more and more I listen even to guys like Graham Oppie, the more I'm like, well, no, philosophy of religion is very, very important in philosophy. Like, whether God exists or not, I don't need to be a, I don't need to feel like I'm a backseat, you know, guy or anything. Like, this is a great study. It's really good. And like you said, it's been central. It's been one of the central questions of philosophy from the beginning.
Yes. And a mark of how important the question, does God exist, is when I was a young man, I began doubting my religious beliefs. I was raised Catholic. And in my early 20s, I began doubting my religious beliefs, starting with the question, why should I believe in God? What reason is there to believe in God? And when I started doubting God's existence, everything else started to fall into doubt. I started doubting my political beliefs. All my worldview beliefs started to bother me, and I fell into this huge existential confusion. So over time, I learned that the existence of God was central to my worldview and central to beliefs about people, about morality, about the objective truth. I think the question, does God exist, is perhaps the most important question in philosophy.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Paul, what do you think the second most important question is in philosophy?
How should I live?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I thought maybe I could get you on your toes there, or on your heels. That's good. You got it right away. How about a definition of philosophy? I think that a lot of, I have a lot of Christian philosopher friends, and less non-Christian philosopher friends, but still a significant amount. And in the Christian community, it's almost like impious to say anything other than philosophy is the love of wisdom. And that's fine. You know, I hear a lot of them say it, but you know, as I'm studying analytic philosophy a little bit more and seeing the divide between them and the continentals, I do think there's a strong divide. And I do think it's weird to try and capture everyone in that definition. And I was just wondering, you know, maybe you like that definition. We could talk about that, but what is philosophy?
Well, I define it pretty standardly as the attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of all on the basis of unaided reason and observation alone.
Mm. Unaided reason.
That's how the Greeks understood it.
Okay.
In my book, I give a brief definition of what a fundamental question is. Fundamental questions are those that have to be answered before we answer all other questions. Questions like, does God exist or not? What is truth and how do we know it? What is social justice? Do we have immaterial souls that live on after the body dies? Mm-hmm. These are fundamental questions. And philosophy is the attempt to answer them, not on the basis of authorities telling us what to believe or blind faith. Mm-hmm. It's the attempt to answer them using our cognitive abilities, our natural cognitive abilities, reason, observation, and perhaps more.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is something else I've been wrestling with. So I got two master's degrees in theology, and then I moved over to philosophy, and I'm working on one of those, and Lord willing, I'll go on to do a PhD in philosophy. And so I have a bunch of different Parkers in my head, and some, yeah, just all over the place. And I'm constantly wrestling with the question of like special revelation in philosophy. Like you mentioned observation and unaided reason. Would you call yourself a Christian philosopher? And if so, is that because you happen to have Christian beliefs, or is it because you do philosophy in a particularly Christian way? Does that question make sense?
That's a good question. I do call myself a Christian philosopher.
Okay.
I doubted my faith for several years back in my early 20s, right, and that's what led me to start studying philosophy, because philosophy, I discovered, is in people seeking to answer questions that were troubling me. But I found my way back to my Catholic faith, or the Christian faith in general, by reasoning it out. I believe that there are good reasons to take the Bible as a work of history, as historically reliable. And I agree with Swinburne and a lot of other major philosophers at major universities that the historical facts surrounding the life of Jesus Christ cannot be explained in any other way than with the Christian doctrine, that the Christian doctrine makes the best sense of the facts by far. And I was very influenced by some of Swinburne's writings on this, including his Resurrection of God Incarnate.
Yeah.
And books like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gary Habermas is a philosopher. I think he's a fine philosopher. He's written deep material on this. I think there's a, I think that the Christian faith is reasonable. I think that it stands the test of reason. So I'm a philosopher who's a Christian. I don't do philosophy in an especially Christian way.
Okay.
I do philosophy as philosophers have always done it since the Greeks, by reasoning about fundamental issues. But I do think reason points to, this is, if I may digress a moment.
Please.
Thank you. This is where faith enters the picture in my interpretation. And this comes out in chapter 6 of my book. I don't believe that reason proves God's existence the way it proves that the square root of 2 is irrational.
Okay.
I believe that reason, when we follow it carefully and sincerely, points us to God's existence. And I don't think it proves it with the certainty of mathematics. I think it points us in the direction of God. And I say in chapter, I hint in chapter 6, perhaps reason doesn't take us all the way to God. Perhaps reason, when we follow it sincerely and deeply, takes us to a point where it says, where it points us towards God and then says, this is as far as I can take you. The next step is yours. And perhaps the next step is faith.
Yeah.
An act of will, but an act guided by reason, mm-hmm. an act motivated by reason. So I think faith can be reasonable in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's not that reason's taking you like to the edge of a boardwalk and you have to jump off, but it's like, I'm trying to think of a better analogy. Like it's
no, that's a good analogy.
Oh, that, okay.
That reminds me of Kierkegaard and of course,
yeah, that's what I was thinking, right?
Yeah. It's not that reason takes us to a brink and then from there, it's just, you can turn any direction you want. I use the word points. I think reason points us to God, to a supreme being of such majesty that it's just beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
But it points us in a direction and then bids us to take the next step.
Okay.
Which I think is faith.
Yeah. Do you think that that's like a necessity? Like there's something about the nature of reason such that it could never bring us to God? Or do you think God set this up in a way to, not to sound like Kant, but make room for faith?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure if this answers the question, but your question makes me think of this idea that goes back to J.N. Findlay, the Platonist scholar. I think we have a natural built-in inclination to want to worship God. Mm. And I think that when reason takes us to the brink, to the edge, to as far as it can take us, I think a reasonable person who says, yes, there must be a God, nothing else makes sense. Hmm. There must be a supreme being who created us for a purpose, who created me for a purpose. I think we have a natural inclination then to want to worship that being.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, so Paul, when getting back to the like Christian philosopher type nomenclature, I guess, are there any things that are off limits for Christian philosophers to think about? Sometimes maybe I've been too influenced by Kant, but I think of Kant's, what is enlightenment? And he's talking about knownage and stuff, and he's criticizing those. He's saying those who hold to creeds and confessions are not enlightened because they're not thinking for themselves. And I wonder, just as a Christian philosopher, and maybe even as a Catholic philosopher in particular, are there certain doctrines where you're like not allowed to go to? You're not allowed to say a question, maybe, I guess.
Well, I would personally say no.
Okay.
I'm with Socrates. I think that we should think about reason about everything, whether Scripture is infallible or fallible, whether the problem of evil, whether we should accept this church doctrine or that church doctrine. I think reason has to play a role.
Yeah.
I know not all Christians will agree with me, but
right. Yes,
I'm a rationalist and a strong rationalist in that sense.
Okay.
I'm not afraid to debate things. I have a philosophical friend who argues that it's highly improbable that Jesus ever existed. Mm-hmm. And years ago, our discussions used to be heated, but they're no longer heated. I'm happy to debate that question. Let's get into the historical sources.
Yeah,
I think it doesn't hurt to debate it if you debate it with reason and sincerity.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool to hear. In the book, you go over like design arguments and cosmological arguments. And just wanted to get your opinion on those. Like, do you think when you're building a case for theism, is one more important? Is one more powerful? One family, I guess, because there's a lot of different design. There's a lot of different cosmological you can go with. Mm-hmm. Do you prioritize one more than the other?
That's a good question. There's the pedagogical standpoint, and then there's the philosophical standpoint. From a pedagogical standpoint, I have found over 40 years of teaching philosophy that 42 years, if you want to be exact.
Okay. Well, we are analytic philosophers. So you got to be precise.
I believe the design argument appeals to students best, and it captures their thought better than the cosmological argument, okay. Definitely far better than the ontological argument. Hmm. So in my book, I started the discussion with the teleological or design argument. It really appeals to students. And I started with Socrates. You know, Socrates is the first person in the historical record to give a detailed argument from design. And I have found that students love Socrates when they get to know something about his life and his integrity. He's a very appealing, marvelous figure in history of philosophy. In some ways, he's my favorite philosopher.
Hmm.
Maybe Plato is. I don't know. I love both of those two characters, but he's a very attractive philosopher, and I start my design argument with Socrates' thoughts on design.
Hmm.
He gave a very profound design argument. But as a philosopher, I prefer the cosmological argument. And as a logician who's in love with modal logic, especially S5 modal logic, I love the ontological argument. I find the ontological argument powerful. I think it can be defended. But the cosmological, I think, for philosophers may be more appealing. I think Aquinas' third way, supplemented with modal logic, is maybe the most powerful argument for God's existence.
Yeah.
But for students, I think we start with the design argument, and then we can go to the cosmological.
Okay.
And then in my book, I combine the two at the end of chapter 6 and point out that if we use Occam's razor carefully, the two arguments kind of wrap together to form an argument, a cumulative argument for one supreme being or deity who is both the cause, the first cause of the universe, and the designer.
Yeah.
There's a being beyond space and time who gave the universe its existence and its order. And that's certainly simpler than supposing there are two deities, one the designer and one the creator.
Yeah. Well, what about... So I didn't see the ontological argument in here. And is that because of the intro book? Or
Yes, because it's an intro book and because of space considerations, I left it out. Yeah.
I also,
when I teach the ontological argument in class, students, it doesn't go over well. either you get into the weeds of S5 modal logic and you lose a lot of the class, or it just sends them into a spiral. I've found that pedagogically, at least at the intro level, the ontological argument doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of, so there's like planning as a modal ontological argument, and that just starts from the premise, you know, possibly God exists, or what does planning say? Not perfect being,
maximally excellent.
Yeah. There we go. So then now there's like this reverse ontological argument where they say, well, hey, look, possibly that maximal being doesn't exist. And there's kind of like this stalemate between like a naturalist or an atheist and a theist. Mm-hmm. And there's like this symmetry that needs to be broken. Any thoughts on like how we can break that and get past the stalemate there at the beginning?
Oh, you're referring to Graham Oppy's work and people inspired by him.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really difficult question. You know, I defended the ontological argument in my logic book, the last chapter, Introduction to Logic. I gave an S5 defense of it.
Okay.
That is such a difficult question.
Yeah.
My intuitions, my modal intuitions, the same intuitions that tell me that S5 is the best explanation of modality in general, tell me that there's a possible world containing a maximally excellent being.
Hmm.